This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes.
We're just the tip of the spear. We're the ones closest to Puerto Rico and closest to Brazil and the other countries that have had a significant outbreak of Zika. But this is an issue for our country. And so the federal government should be a partner. And today, I don't believe they're a partner.
Governor Rick Scott is on the attack, blaming the federal government for lack of Zika funding. But Florida's mosquito experts say it was Scott's own budget cuts that caused them to shut down their research.
He shook my hand and he said he would not veto it, and then he turned around and vetoed it.
Dr. John Smith is here to discuss funding cuts and his ongoing fight to keep research into mosquito-borne diseases alive. Plus, Florida's top civil rights attorney, Tallahassee's very own Benjamin Crump, is about to get even busier.
Nonstop, man. Like I said, I just got back from Los Angeles working on some of these television projects that I'm doing.
You heard it here first. Crump is getting ready to be a household name. And he weighs in on what some are calling a modern-day civil rights movement.
And when it's poor minorities, you get in jail or you getting denied access to the courtroom. And that's what we're fighting against. That is truly what we're fighting against.
All that and more coming up on episode 71 of The Rotunda. Florida is on high alert when it comes to the Zika virus. We are the first state in the nation to have local transmission of this virus. And Governor Rick Scott is busy gathering and dedicating resources to combat its spread.
We are doing continued spraying. We have our Department of Health, the CDC, the State Department of Health, all to make sure that we contain this. Florida's good about mosquito-borne viruses. We've controlled chikungunya and dengue fever, and we'll figure out how to control this.
Scott is frequently on network television spreading awareness and the necessary precautionary measures, like making sure to remove all standing water that could be a breeding ground for mosquitoes. He's been hosting about a dozen roundtable talks on Zika with local leaders around the state.
You know, we started this back in February when we had our first travel-related case.
Scott is even calling out the federal government for not doing enough to help.
Just remember, this is not a state issue. This is a national and international issue. We're just the tip of the spear. We're the ones closest to Puerto Rico and closest to Brazil and the other countries that have had a significant outbreak of Zika. But this is an issue for our country. And so the federal government should be a partner. And to date, I don't believe they're a partner. The Congress went on recess. As governor, I have to work with my legislature. The president needs to work with Congress and get something passed to fund this.
But let's take a look back on the issue of funding. Let's go way back. When Scott was running for office in 2009, and there was a facility called the Public Health Entomology Research and Educational Lab in Panama City Beach. It was headed up by Dr. John Smith.
I served as the director of that center for 20 years until it was closed.
The center was founded in 1964 and was simply known as the Mosquito Lab. Politico's Mark Caputo and Christine Sexton first reported on Governor Rick Scott's record of cutting mosquito control funding. So much so that Smith's lab was put out of business.
We had actually an appropriation approved by the legislature for $500,000 to keep the center going, but Governor Scott vetoed that appropriation, and that effectively closed the center.
So what do you think of Scott's handling of the Zika crisis?
Well, I know he's feeling the pressure. Certainly Zika has attracted a great deal of attention, and he wants the public to know that he's concerned about it and is on top of it. And from my perspective, I just wonder why he wasn't so concerned about it, 5 years ago, before we had Zika, protecting the resources that we had in mosquito research in this part of the state. Since that center is closed, Northwest Florida has been left largely without research resources and technical expertise that it's had for many, many years, and now it has nothing. And many of the smaller rural counties just don't have the expertise needed to combat an outbreak of Zika.
Well, we know what they say about hindsight. But how did it all go down? Was there a fight to keep this research going considering Florida's mosquito-friendly climate? Smith is here to tell the backstory, starting with Scott's broken campaign promise.
Well, it's difficult to say things like this because I don't want to make him feel bad. I know he was doing things that he felt he needed to do at the time. But I would say basically the same thing I mentioned to him when he was running for the governor's position. He came to Panama City. I met with him personally and told him that, you know, I was concerned that there were rumors that if he was elected, he would be cutting jobs, particularly jobs that people had in government, because that seemed to be the thing they were interested in doing at the time. And I told him that, you know, we had a center here that was being proposed to be cut, and we were working with our local legislators to try to keep it going, and asked him if we were able to get a legislative appropriation to keep the lab going, would he please not veto it? And he shook my hand and he said he would not veto it, and then he turned around and vetoed it, which upset me considerably, but you know, he did what he did. I guess he had his reasons for it.
Political reports, Scott also ignored pleas from fellow Republicans to preserve funding the Mosquito Lab, which at the time was a budget item under Florida A&M University. Smith believes the center would have still been operational today if it didn't fall under FAMU's umbrella.
Yeah, every year it operated under that line item budget. And when the center moved over to Florida A&M University, after a few years of operating under the university, that line item kind of disappeared and the budget just became part of the university's budget. So it was easier for the university to shut the center down because of that. If we had kept our line item budget, the center would probably still be there today.
And while on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd, Scott responded to question about his record for cutting the funds.
Earlier this week, the federal government failed the state when it came to Zika. But you also cut some state mosquito control money back in 2011 by 40%. In hindsight, do you regret making that cut? And do you want Congress to go back into session in August and get this funding passed?
What we've done is allocate the dollars better. We reduced some funding in one area, but we dramatically increased the funding over the last 5 years or last 6 years I've been in office. We have very good mosquito boards. I've allocated $26.2 million for the state funding. Mm-hmm. The feds need to become a partner. I asked on Friday, or on Thursday when I met with the CDC, Dr. Frieden, I asked for 10,000 more Zika preparedness kits. We still need the federal government to show up. The president and Congress have to work together. This is a national, international issue. It's not just a Florida issue.
And he's right. Funding has more than doubled since the Mosquito Lab's closure. The state budget includes $2.8 million in aid to local governments, which, according to the Miami Herald, is more than Scott's predecessor, Governor Charlie Crist. But none of those funds are going towards Smith's research. Research that helped him play a key role in discovering the Aedes albopictus mosquito back in the 80s.
Right now, I'm the only person, and I have no state funding, no funding from FSU to do it. I'm just doing it because it's something I've done for many years, and I'm committed to it. But I have to do everything now. Once, at one time, you know, I had technicians that worked with me that helped me maintain our mosquito colonies that we use to do research with. Now I have to do all of that myself. I'm doing everything myself, so I'm quite limited in my abilities.
Smith is now working at Florida State University in Panama City and is in talks for increased funding. But he's holding out hope that Governor Rick Scott will make up for a failed promise.
Well, I could work a lot closer with the counties, especially the small counties who just simply don't have the expertise to do the surveillance and the control they need to to combat something like Zika, working with them to help them get their surveillance programs rolling. We're doing a certain amount of that now, but it's limited a great deal because it has to be paid for by someone, and the counties are having to foot the bill, and they simply don't have the resources to do that. So what surveillance we're doing is very limited, to say the least, and it could be expanded greatly if we had, you know, additional budgetary resources to hire the personnel needed here to work with me in my laboratory.
You're listening to The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes. Visit rotundapodcast.com to keep up with the latest news and information and sponsorship opportunities. Join the Rotunda family by becoming a regular contributor. Just go to rotundapodcast.com and click donate. You can easily make it a recurring contribution. Invite your friends to subscribe to this podcast. Follow us on social media at Rotunda Podcast. And thanks for your support. Look at all your awards. You don't even have room for them on the wall anymore.
I've been very blessed. You know, you try to do the things that are important, try to do good by people, and you hope that what you do will be meaningful. And, you know, every now and then people acknowledge what you're doing.
I'm in the office of famed civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump. It's almost like a chance encounter. Just this morning, he flew in from L.A., and tonight, he's back on a plane headed to Baltimore to receive an award, and then on to Washington, D.C. for a journalism conference, and then off to somewhere else after that. So we caught up for just a casual chat.
How do you keep up with all of this? Do you remember the days when you're in this office by yourself waiting for the next case? Is it so long ago?
I remember our start, and you know, when we started out, we were doing criminal law, personal injury, you know, anything that came through the door. Now we get to pick and choose a little more what we do. We get calls from all around the country, so it's one of those things. You're blessed that people believe you're going to fight for them and that you're going to be able to help them get justice. And so that's what you try to do to the best of your abilities. And you pray to God to help you have them get justice and as much justice as they can get, because in many sense, we're dealing with wrongful death cases, and nothing can ever bring their loved ones back. And so you understand that going into it, that only justice you can get is what remedies they are in the court of law.
The surveillance video shows Trayvon Martin buying Skittles and a can of iced tea. He thought he was about to watch the NBA All-Star game. 20 minutes later, he was dead.
911,
joining us now from Orlando is Benjamin Crump, attorney for Trayvon Martin's parents. Benjamin, good morning.
Good morning.
Will we ever know who threw the first punch?
Well, we don't think that is
completely joining us from Tallahassee, Florida, Benjamin Crump, a lawyer representing the family of Michael Brown. So where am I going wrong here, counselor?
Well, you said a lot there, Bill. And the one thing I think about when you talked about the people who were protesting in the aftermath.
Crump is frequently on network television on the O'Reilly Factor, CNN, MSNBC, and all the other networks.
This morning we are hearing from the attorney for the family of Corey Jones, a name you
and
very
what he
well
needed from
recognize.
The police was a helping hand. And all he got was bullets. And from that moment to this one, his family is still demanding answers.
But soon, Crump will be the host of his own TV show. He's currently in talks with producers, and we can expect a program to drop pretty soon.
Nonstop.
Nonstop, man. Like I said, I just got back from Los Angeles working on some of these television projects that I'm doing. And now we had to come back and try to pay attention to some of these cases that we have going on around the country.
The show is currently in production on the Fox Channel, not the Fox News Network, but the Fox Channel. Important distinction. When everything is finalized, we will definitely have Crump back on the program to dish out and go into detail.
You came on my radar through the Martin Lee Anderson case. That's when I was working for WFSU covering that case. What has changed since then? I think from that case on, your profile has just gone nationwide.
That was the case, the first national case. I often tell people that was Trayvon before there was Trayvon. Obviously, Trayvon is a phenomenon. You know, it's the Emmett Till of our day. It's the tragedy that people will talk about 50 years from now in the same way they talk about Emmett Till, I believe. Mm-hmm. And building Trayvon Martin case, we took a lot of lessons we had learned from Martin Lee Anderson case, and I think that's why we were so successful in making sure that they were not able to sweep his death under the rug.
So what has changed for you since then? What kind, like, how has that shaped the kind of cases that you take?
Well, I don't know if it's changed the type of cases we take. We still do personal injury, wrongful death, civil rights work. But I think what it did, it propelled us to national, international proportions where, you know, I'm not surprised if I get a call from the Bahamas or Jamaica or Canada these days, even Brazil to that extent. And so I think that's what it did. It, you know, people saw your advocacy, they saw your legal acumen, and they said, hey, this is a person that will fight for us. And I think that's what most people want. They want somebody to fight for their lost loved one, whether it be their child or spouse, their dignity and their honor. And that's why they come to you.
Well, how would you categorize where we are today as far as civil rights? I understand you're being honored or have been, or tomorrow being honored and getting an award for your work. Where do we stand as far as modern day civil rights, the civil rights movement?
I think, you know, with the rhetoric going on in this presidential election, it's clear we have work to do. You thought, many believed, with the election of the first black president of the United States, that we were living in a post-racial era, but that clearly isn't the case, because we see how the number of police shootings escalated during the 8 years of the Obama administration. And so I think that is a clear, vivid, apparent illustration of the fact that we are not where we need to be when it comes to civil rights and due process of the law for everybody. And remember, civil rights is this notion, this idea in our mind, it's the due process of the law that makes it real. Just like in the 4th and 14th Amendment, the law's on paper, but the due process part is supposed to apply the impartiality to it to make it fair, this notion that it's going to be fair to all parties, the law and the legal proceedings. But what we see happening over and over again is that it's anything but fair when you are poor and minority. It seems like the laws are arbitrary for people of privilege, but it's consistent when it's poor minorities. You get in jail or you getting denied access to the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're fighting against. That is truly what we're fighting against.
Would you say that is the birth of Black Lives Matter, to bring attention to that injustice?
I think so. I remember doing a interview, I think, with the either the Post or the New York Times, and the reporter went back and played for me an interview at the Million Man March where I said Trayvon Martin life mattered. our children's lives matter. And she said that she believed Trayvon, and Ed Gordon says this, Trayvon gave birth to the Black Lives Matter movement. Michael Brown and Ferguson ignited it.
You're listening to The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes, speaking with civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump.
How do you deal with cases now where, like, you know, we're seeing these injustices? There's the court of public opinion, which you are usually in when you're on national TV and all of that stuff and trying to get people to understand what's happening. But in the end, like we saw in the Freddie Gray case, nothing happened. No one was held accountable, and we're on to the next story. How do you deal with trying a case in the court of public opinion?
Well, two things. The great Johnny Cochran said something that I thought was pretty deep. He said that if every time the police shot a black man in the back, we soon got $1 million, there'd be less black men getting shot in the back. But what recent history has taught me is that that didn't ring true, because in all these cases, we get big civil settlements. You know, these cities and municipalities pay out millions of dollars, but yet the police keep doing what they're doing. There's no deterrent value, I believe, unless the police officers are being held accountable themselves personally and going to jail. And so that's the battle, because in none of these cases, they're not trying to send police officers to jail for killing poor people of color. And so we have to fight against, and people don't like when I say this, the government-sanctioned killing of unarmed people of color. And they say, well, how can you say it's sanctioned? Well, nobody's being held accountable. Then what do you call it? You know, and if somebody is being held accountable, then you should showing affirmatively that you are fighting this. You're saying this absolutely wrong. But the fact that they keep finding ways to intellectually justify these police officers being exonerated, then it goes to the heart and the crux of the matter that in some ways it's being sanctioned by the government. I mean, you got these cases on video everywhere. Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Jonathan Crawford, Ezell Ford, Alicia Thomas, Sandra Bland. I mean, the list goes on, and nobody ever goes to jail. Nobody's ever held accountable for it. So that's the battle. But what keeps me going on these cases is it's better to strike a match than curse the darkness. You gotta keep fighting. And there are glimmers of hope. We were successful with the 13 women we represented in Oklahoma City who was raped by the white police officer. You know, that was the first police officer I can remember in recent history that did horrible things to black people, that actually was held accountable, convicted, and went to sentenced to prison for 250 years. Mm-hmm. And then Akai Gurley, the case in New York, represented his parents. They, we were able to get the conviction. Unfortunately, the judge and the prosecutor, I mean, it's just crazy. Even though the jury find you guilty and so forth, we're not going to put you in jail. We're just going to give you probation.
What I'm seeing, like, I hear you with the there's success on the civil lawsuits and stuff like that, but no real reform within the police ranks. Or do you see it as resistant, like when we're seeing Blue Lives Matter?
I absolutely see resistance. And let me have you make a big point in this interview, and that is the fact that we're not the criminal prosecutors. We're civil lawyers. So we're successful in what we're doing in the civil arena. We're recovering the wrongful death settlements and so forth. And it's only the prosecutor, the elected officials, who can put people in jail. People mistakenly get that wrong and say, well, Ben Crump, you lost Trayvon Martin. I'm like, no, we won what we were supposed to do. That was Angela Cora and the state attorney and them who didn't get a conviction. And I think that discourages a lot of people from going to do the civil rights work because they don't want to be tagged with being unsuccessful. And you have to put those two imposters out your mind, this notion of triumph and disaster. You do it because it's the right thing to do. And people are always going to talk. You know, you're always going to have your critics out there no matter what you do. I learned long ago the height of arrogance was to think everybody was going to love you. You do it because you have the conviction in your heart to say, I want to do what's right, and I have children. And I want to believe that we do this because you would want others to help fight for your children and help you if this was your child. And so I think that's the thing we have to remember. There's a lot of resistance. The young people are smart, and I had some young people in my office, and we were talking, and they were telling me about this equation, and I think it's a good legal equation when you think about it. It says, if you have a problem with Black Lives Matter, but you're okay with All Lives Matter, and you support Blue Lives Matter, then when you do a critical analysis, the only thing you really had in this entire equation, the only thing you had a problem with in this entire equation was Black. And I think that's it. I absolutely think that's it. Clearly, the metaphors are all over the place now. If we're doing breast cancer, and just because we were pink for breast cancer don't mean that we don't support the fight against ovarian cancer or brain cancer or lung cancer. It's just ludicrous. Yeah. But, you know, that's what they put up these things to try to move the focus, to do the bait and switch. Yeah. It's Black Lives Matter too, is really what you're saying. Mm-hmm. You know, they trying to make Black Lives Matter a terrorist group and all this stuff. It's just ridiculous. But that's the same thing they did with the Black Panthers and, you know, every other group that tried to assert their constitutional rights to have the human and civil rights applicable to their Black and brown bodies. And so that's what we're fighting with.
So what is next for you? You're all over the scene. You're on TV, politics. Would you ever jump in on your own?
If you're a private man, I think I can get more done being a private man and being a supporter of politics. We're filing a lot of voting rights cases. We are doing a lot with television now, and we're doing a lot more nationally. We're trying to do cases that influence a greater number of people. You know, you're blessed with this platform. You're blessed with this notoriety. You want to use it for something that matters.
That's it for this edition of The Rotunda. Remember to visit rotundapodcast.com and join us again next week right here for more stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.